Armena Watch, der Talk.
Herzlich willkommen zu dieser Ausgabe des MENA Watch Talks. Wir freuen uns sehr, heute Rabbi Abraham Cooper aus Los Angeles zugeschaltet zu haben. Rabbi Cooper ist der stellvertretende Direktor des Simon Wiesenthal Centers in Los Angeles. Zu den Arbeitsschwerpunkten seiner schon sehr langen Karriere zählen unter anderem der Kampf gegen Antisemitismus und vor allem in den letzten Jahren auch verstärkt das Thema der Normalisierung der Beziehungen zwischen Israel und mehreren arabischen Staaten, Stichwort Abraham-Abkommen. Rabbi Cooper ist uns aus Los Angeles zugeschaltet. Wir werden auf Englisch sprechen eine Zeit lang und bedanken uns auf jeden Fall herzlich, dass er Zeit genommen hat, hier bei uns zu sein. So, Rabbi Cooper, welcome to our talk here. Thank you very much for taking time to talk to us.
It's my honor.
Let us perhaps start with what is going on currently in regard to the war against Hamas in the Gaza Strip and the results that bears in Europe and in the United States. Since this massacre on October the 7th, Europe has been experiencing a massive wave of anti-Semitism. There were the demonstrations in many cities throughout Europe with people virtually celebrating the murder of Jews. In a lot of places, there have been attacks, acts of violence against Jews or Israeli institutions and Jewish institutions. What would be interesting for us from our European perspective, what's the situation in the United States? Are you also experiencing a frightening wave of hatred towards Jews following the October 7th attacks?
Well, thank you for having me on. I think there are a few points I'd like to share with people who will be watching this. Well, first of all, in terms of anti-Semitism, in wake of October 7th, there's been a huge increase in the United States and, as you know, in the United Kingdom and across Europe. I would say that most of us were quite shocked because of the unparalleled, unprecedented brutality that the Hamas terrorists, call them Nazis, showed on the 7th in terms of the mass murder of 40 Israeli infants and everything else we've heard of, the largest single pogrom against the Jews in one day since the defeat of Hitler in 1945. So in the early phase of the next few days, I was interviewed by many people from Europe, European correspondents, who openly said that their sympathies had been with the Palestinian cause. They think that the Palestinians deserve their own state. But they would say, I didn't sign up for this, meaning the Nazi brutality, in some ways worse than Nazi Germany. We're named after Simon Wiesenthal, the Nazi hunter. His job was especially difficult because the Nazis worked so hard to erase evidence. Here you have Hamas and its supporters broadcasting the murders, celebrating the murders, using the murders and the mass rape and all the rest in order to recruit to their cause. So one would have hoped, almost assumed, that people around the world would have understood that this was not just another round of violence between Hamas and Gaza and Israel. Every couple of years they have, well, for the Jewish people, of course, something has fundamentally changed, for world Jewry as well. But what we have witnessed in the United States is the exact opposite of what we expected. And where it primarily comes from is also a brutal wake-up call for us. The hate crimes may be against institutions and Jewish individuals, etc., but the source of this level of genocidal hate emerges from protests primarily on our campuses, on our elite universities, Columbia University, Penn University. I'm based here in Los Angeles. We have what's called the UC system, University of California system, one of the best university chains in the world. almost every single UC campus in California. We've had outrageous situations, including in one case, a professor calling for the murder of a Jewish journalist. And so we've seen the validation of the Hamas narrative. There's been a profound change. So not so many years ago, the debates were, well, will East Jerusalem be the capital of Palestine? Where will the final borders be? All sorts of technical questions about the inevitable two-state solution. You don't even hear any of that anymore. What we hear one way or the other is from river to the sea, Palestine will be free, Israel apartheid, occupation, blood libels, et cetera, et cetera. And this is emanating from the most elite elements of academia and universities. Further, you know, in the United States, over the last few years, we had, I think, two major moments. The killing of George Floyd, which led to Black Lives Matter, et cetera, and Ukraine. And one of the developments in both of those major events was the emergence of the CEOs of major institutions and companies speaking out on behalf of social justice, equity, speaking out on behalf of the people of Ukraine, putting their money where their mouth is. When it came to October 7th, generally speaking, especially in the immediate aftermath, we heard virtually nothing from those same sources. No empathy, no condemnation, nothing. And so from the halls of academia to the power halls of United States companies, we did not see any significant sense of outrage to what had taken place or empathy for a wounded Jewish community. I think this came as a great shock to many American Jews and also as a wake-up call. When the extent and the nature of the mass murders and the rapes and the kidnappings took place, I don't know about Austria, I can say about the United States, almost all of the Jewish institutions and individuals, whether left, right, or center, felt an overall sense of revulsion, some fear that it could happen, and a new solidarity with Israel's announcement that it would not stop until it killed the people responsible for that, hopefully all the way up the chain, and no discussions about ceasefire or anything else until that initial objective was obtained. And even though the Israeli military and the Israeli people understand why they have a military and always try their best not to hurt civilians or to kill them, we've seen now the growing drumbeat of call for ceasefire from maybe the day after, while the fighting was still going on. It's like these are individuals and groups that are instructed about what to say and how to say it, even as the Hamas spokesmen say, yes, they want a ceasefire, meaning they want Israel to cease firing. But of course, it doesn't extend to them because they have the moral high ground and the right to do everything in order to get rid of the occupation and the occupiers. So there is a real sense of solidarity now beginning to see some pushback, starting with Secretary Blinken and our president, that no, we need a humanitarian pause or ceasefire. And there will inevitably be members of the Jewish community who will join such calls. I think in this case, they're misplaced. And I do not think that that the Israelis will allow their leaders to stop. The X factor in all of this, of course, is what the Iranians, who the puppet masters in this situation to begin with, paid for, trained, whether and to what extent they're going to utilize Hezbollah. Because if Hezbollah goes much further than they already have, and of course, no, it's not us, it's the Hamas in Lebanon, it's this group. Nothing happens in southern Lebanon without Hezbollah's involvement. And you well know the 150,000 rockets and missiles pointing towards Israel. It's a high, very high stakes game. But I think the assumption here is, if God forbid, it does expand more than it already has, that the Iranians are going to feel something in the next round. This is not just about Hezbollah. And we now, you know, of course, have seen the significant missiles sent towards Israel from Yemen and intercepted by the United States Navy. We read this morning here that Algerian parliament is signaling to its president he could declare war in Israel. Not exactly sure what Israel has done to Algeria recently, but there are a lot of buttons being pushed, of course, stuff coming from Iraq, from the Golan Heights, etc. But the main focus right now is Iran and whether or not the Iranian regime believes that there is a true red line put down by the United States. If they believe for a moment it's not true, then they may push everything literally to the brink. And as someone who has spent over the decades some time volunteering in Kiryat Shmona, in one of the northern communities, 20,000 plus Israeli citizens are now internal refugees from northern Israel. So none of us can predict exactly what's going to happen, except I would say that the level of solidarity and commitment on the part of Jewish people, both in Israel and around the diaspora, has never been this intense this widespread, perhaps since the 1967 war.
You've mentioned Hezbollah, and we all do not know what they're going to do in the next couple of days. Hezbollah General Secretary Hassan Nasrallah is supposed to speak, I think, right at the same time.
He has actually spoken. I think that perhaps the most interesting of his statements is that the atrocities of October 7th were committed by the Israelis.
Sure.
Right. So if you want to have a class in lies, libels, misdirection, they've been playing a very coy game. You have to absolutely admit that the Iranian game plan of lulling, to a certain extent, Israel into a sense that maybe they could have some ongoing, more or less quiet with Hamas, was just a ruse. And then I think the other very important element, especially since some of the international offices of the United Nations are based in Vienna, has been the absolute abject failure of the United Nations to do the right thing. I think everyone knows that as we speak, the Iranians are now the chair of the one of the most important commissions of the United Nations Human Rights Council. That in the days following October 7th, there was a moment of silence at the United Nations Human Rights Council's event in Geneva, in which they made it clear that they were standing in silence for the victims, the Palestinian victims of Israeli occupation. UNICEF, we've heard next to nothing. This is the group that's supposed to be caring for children. and they do some important work around the world. And yet, when you had the mass murder of babies and children, etc., early on, and even as we speak now, reports of 30 Jewish children still held captive and probably being used as human shields by Hamas, not one word from the United Nations, children's address. UNRWA, the UNRWA institutions have been in Gaza, many of them converted openly now to launching sites and other military use, a complete control. But even before then, UNRWA was teaching a war curriculum, not a peace curriculum. And Austria, Germany, US, Japan, France, UK, give enormous amounts to UNRWA without even doing their basic due diligence about what's being done with the money in terms of brainwashing generation after generation of young people. They never see a map of Israel. They're never taught of the Jewish people's legitimate place in the Holy Land, nothing. And every time, and I just got back from Tokyo, I go very often to Asia. When I raise this with donor nations, it's just a shrug of the shoulders saying, in effect, well, we want to be players. And in order to do so, we have to kick in to this fund. But in fact, when you see what it is that the Hamas terrorists, or otherwise known on media in Europe and around the world as militants or soldiers, their soldiers, like the SS butchers, were soldiers. And after World War II, they were adjudicated as a criminal organization. So these Nazi terrorists, where do they get this hate from? Where do they get this encouragement from their own parents? Where did it come from? It comes from their education. You're not born with that level of hate. This is inculcated. And, you know, frankly, the United States Secretary of State would have been much better, instead of shuttling back to Israel now the third time, much better to focus sitting down with the United Nations, with the CEO, Secretary General Guterres, whose offices I was in about 2 weeks ago. The Simon Wiesenthal Center is an NGO at the UN. Even he didn't get it. I believe that so many of the diplomats live in this delusional bubble in which they were not or refused to just change their worldview based on the facts on the ground. It reminded me of one, I'm not going to use his name, but one of the first Holocaust deniers in the United States, prominent because he was a professor at Northwestern University. And he was once on CNN, this must have been a quarter of a century ago. And the host showed him the footage from Auschwitz and the other camps and said to him, "Professor, how could you possibly deny? Take a look. How could you deny that Auschwitz didn't take place?" And I think what he said was quite telling, maybe the most honest statement he ever made in his life. He said, I don't believe those pictures or the evidence that you show, because I'm more comfortable not believing that Auschwitz took place." So we're dealing, in a sense, with two mindsets. The many people in the world who don't feel comfortable having to change their worldview about the Palestinian leadership because they've been taught and over and over again by the media and others that what the Nazis did to the Jews in the 30s and 40s in the previous century, the Jewish people in Israel are doing to the Palestinians. An absolute libel, and that has been absorbed and internalized by millions of people in Europe. What are they supposed to do with that belief when they're shown the footage from Hamas? So either you change your worldview Or you take the professor's view is, look, I'm more comfortable not changing my worldview, so don't confuse me with the facts. And then, but that's on one level. But the people who are in charge of diplomacy in our world, for them to sort of make, oh, this is just another round of violence, no. And for the Jewish people, no. And for the people in Israel, no. And for the threats that if you don't, take your kippah or Star of David off and cower in the corner, no. Right now, we still live in a democracy, and it's up to each of us to, first of all, stand up for our rights. And I think that law enforcement here is doing the best that it can. But, you know, Simon Wiesenthal told us, I remember one time in 1980, there was he was giving a lecture at a university. I happened to be with him in the Midwest of the U.S. 1980, it's a long time ago. And he was asked by a student in the audience, Mr. Wiesenthal, were you surprised by how many Nazis there were? And his answer was, I found compelling, said, no, I wasn't surprised by how many Nazis there were. I was surprised by how few anti-Nazis there were. And I think that, in a sense, is the situation today. I'm not a military person. I don't hold a gun. I can't fight Hezbollah in any way. But what we can do and should do, and why it's so important, especially for people in Austria, to do, is we need to create new alliances, new friendships. We need to deepen those relationships to create new coalitions that eventually will be the backbone to contribute to real peace in the Middle East. And I would say also that perhaps I'd be a lot more depressed if I hadn't been involved over the last decade and a half in outreach and interaction in the Gulf region, well before the Abraham Accords were even a distant dream. So I think what Jews and Arabs and Muslims proved to each other from the Abraham Accords is that if you actually meet the other and go beyond stereotypes, anything is possible. I saw those stereotypes melt away. I see now the efforts led by Iran desperately to derail all of the achievements of Abraham Accords with one goal in mind, to make sure that Saudi Arabia doesn't make peace with Israel. If you want to look behind the curtain about what it is the Ayatollah wants, well, number one, he wants Jews dead for theological reasons. Number two, he fears Israel and he fears the United States, and he wants to weaken both of those as his theocracy, which they want to, they are exporting all over the world, his view is to take on the powers that be, weaken the United States, try to get rid of the little devil, or weaken it dramatically, on en route to becoming not just the regional power, but a dominant world power. That's their goal. And I would say that it's extremely important for the leadership, not only in the U.S., but all the leaders in NATO, as well as the important, I would say, outsize role that Austria plays on the international stage in so many of the international issues that come up. Austria is involved, and I think that's something that should continue to be encouraged. But we expect that the government of Austria and the people in Austria will seek and absorb the truth of what has happened, and then be available as a friend of Israel, be available for the day after the conflict hopefully is won, to help move quickly the efforts towards expanded reconciliation and peace between the state of Israel and her neighbors. The one thing Israel doesn't want, doesn't need now, and will reject: we don't need lectures from anyone about how the Israeli military should or should not operate. For us, every single soldier is lost. It's an entire world that is lost. Israel has a large and effective military, but it is not a militaristic society. The sons and daughters go to the front lines because they have to defend their homes. I believe that for anyone who's a thinking person and go beyond just the accepted rhetoric, pro-Palestinian, basically from the Palestinian point of view, they continue to have a moral blank check to operate even after October 7th. That itself is an outrage and has to be fought by decent people everywhere. And that peace itself further enrages the state of Israel, the people of Israel, her Zionist supporters, Jewish and non-Jewish, around the world. But I would also just caution that because especially social media, we haven't spoken about it, but it plays an outsized role now in every conflict, in every controversy. If anyone thinks that the evildoers elsewhere around the world, terrorist cells and flashpoints all over, unfortunately, all over the planet, that there aren't evildoers taking notes about October 7th, that this is just going to end one way or the other with the Jewish state and the Arabs, that's a pipe dream. October 7th, there was a red line crossed, unfortunately, again by humanity. And the outcome of what takes place as a result of that attack is right now still up in the air. But the long-range implications for how wars are fought, how causes are promoted and justified, when you erase that line between fundamental human decency and fighting for a quote-unquote holy cause, then I'm afraid all of humanity, wherever we live, is going to be threatened. So a lot is at stake here, first and foremost for the Jewish people, but beyond what Hamas represents, what Hezbollah is, and what the Iranian regime currently represents should have a direct impact on who democracies deal with. Is it export uber alles? Is it just about oil at the end of the day for Europeans? And I think one last point is, it took a long time for me to return to Vienna. My first visit was in 1978 when Mr. Wiesenthal was heroically doing his job there. And the Vienna I returned to last year was a different Vienna, a different Austria. And I've spoken, about it publicly. But the litmus test for Austria, for Germany, and other European countries is not how many people and politicians come up to stand in silence for dead Jews. It's how many politicians in Austria and Germany and UK and France and the US stand up in solidarity for and with live Jews. That's really the question going forward.
I think there's really no better way of ending our talk than this very important statement. Rabbi Cooper, once again, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. I wish you all the best and hope that maybe once we may have the opportunity to speak again in better times in the near future. Thank you very much.
It'll be my honor, and I'm sure there will be better times, starting with Israel's victory in this just war.
Thank you.
God bless.
You too.
Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns. Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.